to the Process Podcast, an interview series exploring the process of survival as a creative. Typically, we talk to folks from all sorts of backgrounds and industries about money, mental health, relationships, the creative process itself, and more. For this season, we're trying something a little bit new and experimenting with theme seasons. And for this one, we're focusing on music, bands, artists, and industry folks. Big thanks to Desert Days Music Fest for helping make a lot of these interviews happen. Visit desertdays.org to check them out and to grab your tickets for the fest in the fall of this year. Also, thank you to Ton Starts Bandit for providing their song Wet Ass Morning as our intro and outro music, and to Hannah Spencer for doing all of our branding and design work. Hope you dig it. Hi.
Hello.
I'm getting a little bit bummied. A little bummed would be another way of saying that this season is so close to ending. But good news is that we still have a few more episodes. This one is with Amanda Guest, who is the founder and general manager of BFF.fm, a community and internet community radio station based in San Francisco, California. This is a great episode for anyone, if I do say so myself, but especially for people interested in, although the season is all about music, but I think this one in particular is great for anyone interested in like community leadership or community organizations or nonprofits, stuff like that. We get, I don't want to say in the weeds because I find it super interesting, but we talk a lot about some of the pain points and how they're overcoming them or growing and adding structure and processes to an organization so that it can sustain past the founder's engagement with it. So we talk tactics in terms of that. Amanda also shares her journey, her community radio journey, which goes back deep and is like super interesting. We talk about revenue models and stuff, how she's managed full-time work with running a radio station, what their DJ model looks like, how you could potentially become a BFF.fm DJ. Yeah, we get kind of deep on the relationship between corporate funding and the arts and what that looks like in San Francisco today and what it could potentially look like in the future, maybe, as well as a local Bay Area music scene and more. Hope you dig it. As a reminder, next week we have an interview with the band Beak and then with Rick McGuire of Pyle. Sweet. Hope you enjoy it. See you next week. Cheers.
My name is Amanda Guest, and I'm the founder and the general manager for BFF.fm, which is an awesome online community radio station broadcasting in San Francisco. And that's where we are right now.
In the Secret Alley.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you also briefly describe the Secret Alley?
The Secret Alley is an artist workshop, so... like, how do we even describe it? The Secret Alley is an artist workshop for different artists who work primarily in media technology. So filmmakers, the radio station is here. We have a drone photographer and someone who makes chiptune music and raps and is also a yo-yo champion. So it's a pretty eclectic crew of people that are in this space.
With a very eclectic decor.
Yeah, it literally, they built an indoor alley. So when you walk in the space, you're confronted by all these different buildings, which are offices where people work. And then it opens into a shared common space, which looks like an outdoor park. And BFF.fm is located in two offices here. One is a sea shack that has a ship crashing through it. And then the inside is a library on a submarine, and then the studio where we're sitting right now, Studio B, is a private investigator's office.
How long has BFF been around?
BFF has been on the air since September 2013, so we've been around for about 5.5 years now.
Okay, yeah. You started, like exactly a year before I did the whole Solnity thing.
Oh, cool, yeah.
Yeah, can you share why you started just walk us through the journey, like how it all happened and how it went from like idea to I'm gonna do this.
I guess it all started back in 1994. I was 17 and I just went I just started at a local college. And on my first day, they had all the groups and clubs get up and kind of pitch why you should join each group or club. Mm-hmm. And someone mentioned that there was a radio station on the campus. And I had heard the station for the first time maybe like a week before that. I was listening to radio in my bedroom late at night, and I heard just like the weirdest song I had ever heard. And the DJ came back on and said, "This is WMWM 91.7 FM. And I had never heard that station before, had no idea what it was. And then when I went to school on my first day, I finally made that connection of like, oh, this is college radio, which is something that I had never even really knew existed. And so I went down. The station was in the far, far reaches of the basement of the campus center. It used to be a bowling alley. Oh, wow. And so it was like really tucked away. And there were all these just like really like the epitome of what you would imagine a college radio crew in the basement of a campus center to be. Yeah. So like a lot of punks and just like kids that were, you know, that the station was where they had found their niche to fit in. But I got down there and they told me, "We only play underground music. We only play indie rock. You can't play anything that's been on a commercial radio station before." Mm-hmm. And it was so strict that there was even a small independent alternative station a couple towns away. And their DJs would listen to our station and get ideas for like what bands were up and coming. Oh, wow. And then they would play some of that stuff. And as soon as they played a song, we weren't allowed to play it anymore. So it was it was pretty, it was super strict. And up until that point, I had only ever really listened to like rap and show tunes. So I really had a lot of learning to do. And it's kind of funny because I started out thinking like, oh, this will be so cool. I'll be a cool DJ and I'll get like people to listen to me and I'll have something to say. But once I got into it, I really started to geek out on exploring all of this music that I had no idea existed before. And then that kind of became the thing that kept me doing it. Basically, years went by and it was 2010.
What was the school?
Salem State College. Okay. Which is now a university, so pretty sweet.
In which Salem?
Salem, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, sweet.
I grew up in the Witch City. Yeah. and it was a 130-watt station, although we used to say that it was 130,000 milliwatts so that we would sound bigger. but anyway, yeah, like I just kind of like, you know, no matter what I was doing in my life, I had like changed careers and had moved, you know, to a different town. And but like doing my radio show just became this through line of my life where like no matter what else had changed, I always wanted to be there and always wanted to do a show in some capacity. And even like over the years, the genres of music that I played changed. But by 2010, I was doing an underground radio show primarily because the really strict rules that were there in the 90s had really dissolved. Mm-hmm. And we had DJs that were like playing a lot of Train and more top 40 stuff. And the station had kind of drifted away from its original intention. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of like, I'll show these kids, and started doing like a really, you know, a strictly formatted underground show like I had back in the day. And it was cool to kind of like encourage other students, like young, I shouldn't say other students, yeah. Encourage the younger students at the station that, you know, indie rock was the way and they should really be into this music because it's great.
What was like your personal aesthetic? You said you're into rap and show tunes, but aside from that, like what was your crew like before you, like as you were joining the radio station?
Well, so the college was in my hometown and a lot of people had gone away to college, so starting over was kind of like a new start for me as far as, you know, I wasn't like hanging out with the same people from high school. A lot of them had gone away to college, and my personal aesthetic at the time was I had a big aubergine perm and I wore like hand-painted t-shirts and flannel. I mean, this was 1994. So, yeah. And then I would wear my dad's ripped jeans and Birkenstocks with socks.
Awesome. Okay, very Salem, from what I imagined.
I mean, it's kind of more Salem, Oregon than Salem, Mass, but yeah, it was definitely like a very college aesthetic for sure. And Yeah, and that obviously that evolved a bit, but it was kind of like, oh, I'm underground now. I have to like be sort of grunge.
That
I don't know.
That's yeah, what happened. That's what I would, how I would like get into the scene for sure.
Yeah, totally.
Real hard into this.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because later on, because I was at the station for like a really crazy amount of time, so later on there was like the early 2000s, like little white belt, skinny yeah. jeans thing, and I saw that happening. But by then, it was like I was old enough that I resisted the urge to like be a total scenester,
right. yeah.
but still went to a lot of shows and just kind of like mellowed out into my own thing.
Yeah, totally. Awesome. So what happens when you leave college?
Well, so when I left college, I stayed at the station.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's how you're able to like influence a younger crew.
Yeah. I mean, I basically like woke up one day and realized I've been doing this for 20 years.
No way.
Yeah. Wow. It got to the point where when I left the station and moved to San Francisco, the program director was born in 1994, which was the year that I started. And it was also really funny because at the station, there were these two really distinct groups of people. There were the students that ran the station and did most of the programming, and then there were the community members, but they tended to be like 50 to 60-year-old white men. Huh. And then also my hometown has a big Latino population, so there were a lot of like Spanish language shows too. Cool. So there was this like cohort that I transitioned into that was really strange because yeah. I was sort of like the bridge between the two because I was a little too young to be in the community member group, although I had some friends and we hung out.
Yeah.
But then I also like didn't really fit into this new cohort either. So it was like definitely an interesting place to be.
Side tangent. Do you watch High Maintenance, the show?
No.
Oh, man. I watched a new episode last night, and in Massachusetts, this like old, like 60-year-old dude who's like in the community radio station, like really into it. Reminded me of it.
Yeah, now I want to watch it because yeah. I probably know that guy.
Probably. cool. So that was like your job, was working at the radio station.
No,
volunteer.
Yeah, I was a volunteer DJ. It took me a really long time to finish college because I paid my own way and didn't really want to get into debt because I saw which is kind of, I think, thank God, I was pretty prescient. But at the time I was just like, I don't want to get into a load of debt. I saw some of my friends doing that and I didn't want to, and I was paying for it all myself. And so a lot of semesters I would, you know, I'd work all summer long full time. And then when it came time to enroll, I'd be like, okay, well, I have enough to pay for a full semester, maybe the fall semester. But then in the spring I might go part time. Just because, you know, whatever I could write a check for, that's what I would do. So it took me nine years to finish. It took a long time. So I started out as a biology major. I became an art major, and then I left for a couple years and wound up going to a local community college and getting my associate's degree because it was cheaper. And I was still like, I didn't really know what I was doing. So it seemed better to just kind of stop and reset as opposed to, you know, flounder. Yeah. And then when I went back, I was kind of like, okay, I went to my advisor and we looked at all my credits and I was like, okay, what's the path of least resistance for me? And it kind of came down to either majoring in psychology, because I had taken a ton of psychology classes because I was really interested in that, or I could do English or communications or marketing. And marketing was at my school was more, it was in the business school, so it was a lot more about like economics and statistics and that sort of stuff, and that didn't appeal to me. And I somehow I felt that getting a communications degree might be more valuable than an English degree. And I also really liked the idea of, oh, I can do marketing with a communications degree without having to take all those business classes.
Yeah.
So that's basically what I wound up doing. And that's how I got out with the credits that I had. Yeah, so I graduated in 2003. Then I stayed at the station. I think I took like a year or two off. Yeah, I did because... because one day I got an email from my friend who was the music director back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And he had gotten an email because he was still working in music promotion. So he basically went over to the other side. He went from being a music director to a promoter for an indie label. And he got an email from WMWM saying that, you know, we know that you used to be music director here. They were like, there's this room in the station and the door's locked and we can't find the key. And the room just looks bananas. We don't understand what's going on in there. What was this other room used for? And it turned out it was my office when I was the general manager. And I had put all these posters up and I used to go to Salvation Army or like other thrift stores and I'd buy weird stuff and just glue it to the walls. And I guess after I left, I had turned in my key and it got lost and no one had been in that room since 2003. And it was now, I think, like 2009, 2010. And so it was like this weird mystery room. And I happened to have saved a spare key just as a souvenir for myself. So anyway, I contacted the current general manager and I was like, hey, you know, I heard you have some questions about this room. I have the key. Maybe you'll let me come down and open the door and then maybe you'll let me do a radio show because I haven't done one in a few years. So that was kind of how I got back into doing a show. I think I took like 2 years off in the middle there. But anyway, that kind of got me up to 2010. I was doing the show. I was interviewing a different underground artist every week on my show. And I just started noticing over and over and over again that the people that I was excited about contacting were from the Bay Area. I also, at the time, was working for a publishing company working on game development books. And so I would have to come to San Francisco usually, you know, once or twice a year. I would come for the Game Developers Conference. That was kind of my first reintroduction to San Francisco as an adult, because I had been here once before when I was 12 and loved it. It was my favorite part of the trip next to Disneyland. and it's funny because at the time when I was a kid, I thought, oh, this is a city where really cool adults live.
Especially back then, like, yeah.
So I was really, you know, I came back as an adult and I thought, oh, this is still really cool. I like the vibe here and all the bands and musicians I like are from here. You know, I would come just for fun a couple times a year too. And I made friends here and I would sublet my friend's room when I met another masshole. And so he would come back to Massachusetts to visit his family and I'd stay in his room while he was gone. We just started connecting with more and more people and decided in 2011 that in 2012 we were going to move to San Francisco, which basically meant like upending everything. Like we owned a house, you know, I had a job that I had to then kind of navigate. How am I going to, you know, get out of this and go to a more expensive area?
Is we, you and your partner?
Yeah, my husband. Yeah. My husband works from home, so he was fine. Yeah, he could go anywhere. He's also originally from Colorado, so staying in New England wasn't really a priority for him. And he had that experience of coming across the country and trying, you know, living in a totally different city. And I'm one of those people that had grown up and was an adult, you know, 20 miles from where I was born. So I really wanted to have that experience of going to someplace completely different and building my own life. So we decided to do that in 2012. But kind of the thing that was really stuck in the back of my mind is, you know, when I go to San Francisco, how am I going to radio? And I had noticed, like, unlike New England, there aren't as many colleges. You know, the Boston area just has, you know, hundreds of schools and dozens of college radio stations. And that isn't the case here. That's kind of how I discovered community radio. You know, I found that there were a number of stations, maybe not necessarily transmitting through frequencies, but broadcasting online. And I applied to all of them, and only one of them ever got back to me. So I joined Mutiny Radio shortly after moving here. And, you know, had a great time, but looking around at the people, other people that were on the station, it was mostly talk shows. There were other people that did music shows, but there, you know, I was kind of the only person playing new underground music at the time. There was like a jazz show and, you know, oldies, but
the crowd, like, or the audience, did it skew older? for the most part? Do you know?
It was a little hard to say. I don't really know. They didn't really have much of a way to track that sort of thing. But just looking at I would say if you're looking at the community and, you know, what the people in the community look like, they're pretty varied, but for the most part, older, 30s, 40s, 50s. So, yeah, I just really missed that moment of my day where I could like go to the station and geek out with everyone about music and share some new things and know that, you know, what I was doing was having a positive impact on local or underground artists. And it just so happened that around that time, Mutiny had been thinking about moving to a different space, which they ultimately didn't do. They're still at 21st in Florida, but they were looking at space. And so I was kind of helping. I was a director at the station. So I was helping, you know, look at listings and decide, you know, what are we going to look at. So that gave me a lot of insight into how much things cost. Yeah. Basically, how it all came together was a friend of mine is good friends with a few of the people that started the Secret Alley, and I had become friends with one of the originators of the space as well. So she was invited to have a little birthday party here for her 30th birthday, and I was invited, and it was my first time actually coming here, even though I knew one of the people that made it. I just had seen pictures of it online. And it was kind of funny because I used to, like, before moving here, I would see pictures of the Secret Alley and I would think about, like, what if I can't find a radio station to join? And I would kind of have these daydreams of, like, it would be so cool to, like, have a station in a space like the Secret Alley. Yeah. So the fact that that's literally what happened is kind of crazy. But yeah, I came in for this party and there was a for rent sign in the window of the studio across the hall from where we are right now. Yeah, I just decided here's an opportunity. I could bring this opportunity back to Mutiny and as, you know, one of a bunch of options for where that station could go, or this could be my chance to start something new. So like all good things, BFF.fm was born in a bar. A few friends and I used to go to Thieves Tavern on 14th Street on Wednesdays. It was kind of jokingly like work from home Wednesdays. But it was, the bartender was Luke Spray, who's now the host of Rollover Easy. And I was there with Alan Huff, who writes the blog Mission Mission. And I wrote kind of like a manifesto. Like, if I had a radio station, this is what I would want it to be. And this is, you know, what I would want it to sound like. And these are the types of people that I would want involved. And basically said, okay, well, I'm going to bring this to the Secret Alley and kind of pitch this idea. And luckily, they said yes. And we moved in. Also, there was like that awkward moment where I went home and told my husband, hey, I'm starting a radio station. I'm cashing out my retirement and I'm going to do this. So yeah, so initially we made a pretty decent investment into getting the initial equipment that we were using and for paying the rent on the space. And we figured out that we could afford to pay the rent for 3 months. And we were like, okay, 3 months. It's an experiment.
And he's pretty supportive.
Yeah, definitely. Also, Forrest, my husband, is now the station engineer, and he built most of the technological infrastructure for like streaming and all the audio stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, he kind of got sucked into it. But I appealed to him with, here's like a cool technical problem that you can try to solve. Because I had seen all the equipment and knew what we needed, but had no idea how it interacted with each other or like, you know, how it all connects and the sound goes out.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, we were like, okay, 3 months. And if it doesn't work out, that, you know, that's a bummer.
Yeah.
That was a big waste of money. It just turned out that we launched the station with 5 shows in September of 2013. And then right around that time in October was Treasure Island Music Festival. Mm-hmm. And the Bold Italic had hired a boat to take people over to Treasure Island.
Okay.
And they needed a DJ. But they couldn't find anyone to do the job because there was no equipment. It was a whale watching boat. It was not,
yeah.
It wasn't like a luxury party.
Radio.
Yeah, yeah. But it wasn't even like a party boat. It was a whale watch boat. So they needed someone that had all the equipment to set up DJing on the boat. And they also needed someone who could tear down all that equipment in the middle of the day and so that the whale watching boat could take people out for whale watches and then set it all up at nighttime.
Okay.
And I saw this as a great opportunity to align BFF with this really big known brand. Yeah. And so I was like, yeah, we'll do it. And I told them, you know, pay me half and then write a story about us. Mm-hmm. And so they were going to do this advertorial about us. But then when they came to talk about, you know, what was going to go into it, they got really excited and they were like, no, we want to make this like a front page feature article. And that was when The Bold Italic was getting like 7 million views a month.
For listeners, The Bold Italic is a, would you call it a design publication? Like, how would you describe The Bold Italic?
The Bold Italic, yeah, it was like part design publication, part local blog.
Yeah.
I think it started out more about design, but it started to really become, you know, kind of a reflection of what was going on culturally in the local scene.
Mm-hmm.
So all the articles were about, you know, stuff happening in San Francisco. There were listicles like, what neighborhood should I live in? They became sort of like a trend spotter or influencer because they would report on new things that were happening and they could really, you know, make something take off, which is what happened with us.
Cool.
So, you know, we went from, oh, we'll have like a small little blurb in their advertorial section to we had a front page, top of the page article, and the graphic said BFF.fm is San Francisco's best new radio station.
Oh, nice.
So it just really, it was crazy how much of an impact that had. And it was funny because they told me, oh, the, you know, we're going to post it sometime at the end of November, but they never gave me a date. And how I found out the article went live is I was walking down the street and my phone buzzed and then my phone buzzed and then my phone buzzed and I picked up my phone and looked at it and it was like DJ application, DJ application, DJ application. In about an hour, I got 20 DJ applications and it was all people that had read this article and like immediately were like, sign me up. And that's kind of how BFF launched because at the beginning, we were completely funded by the DJs.
Uh-huh.
So every DJ that joins the station pays a membership fee each month of $50.
Mm-hmm.
And that was literally paying the rent and keeping the lights on and paying all the expenses. So it's like we needed to have a mass of DJs just in order to keep this thing open.
Yeah.
And then in 2015, we became a 501c3, and we started reaching out to our listeners, and it started with building a second studio. So we did a Kickstarter to build Studio B, and that was successful, and from there, over the past few years, we've just been building up relationships with our listeners and getting listeners to support us financially so that the burden is lifted from the DJs. And we're not quite to the point yet where DJs don't have to pay dues. But we are at the point where if we have a DJ that joins and they can't pay dues for some reason, it's not a struggle to try to make up that money. Yeah, now we can be pretty open to everyone. And for the most part, you know, we have just a really diverse group of DJs. And we have everyone, you know, people that are unemployed all the way to people that, you know, are making six-figure salaries at big tech companies. Some of the people that are, you know, more well off are actually subsidizing DJs that can't afford to pay also.
Nice.
Yeah, I think it's great that we're kind of able to all hang together and exist, and there isn't that feeling of entitlement of like any one show being any bigger than another, even though, you know, some obviously are more popular than others.
Right. Ben was saying how one of your DJs was saying how he's come to find that the community in community radio kind of feels like the people who are actually working in community radio often, like it's a pretty tight-knit group.
Yeah, I'm
supportive group, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is like a big, that's something that I've worked really hard to cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have been part of stations before, and there have even been moments at my college station, depending on who was running things at the time, where people didn't really feel connected to each other. And it was kind of like you went into the studio, you did your show, you never saw another person because the person before you didn't show up, or, you know, there's dead air, or there just isn't, you know, people aren't hanging out in the space and using it in that way. So I've worked really hard to create this culture where the DJs that are part of the station over over other stations come here because they want to be part of something larger than just their own show, and they want to contribute to, you know, making it bigger and stronger in some way. And, you know, like with any community, there are some people that are super involved and other people that do show up, do their show and go home. Mm-hmm. But I feel like we have a really good balance in that most of the people that are here really, really care about it, which is great. And I think one of the other like smaller things that always annoyed me about doing community or college radio would be like showing up and like needles on the turntables are broken or a cord doesn't work that you rely on. And for the most part, that just doesn't happen here. And people, that's kind of the one thing where when DJs from other community radio stations come here, they can't believe that we provide needles on the turntables and they're not broken and that things are clean all the time. And that is really unusual. And some of the DJs that join us that don't have other radio experience might not realize that, but it is really unique and special.
Yeah. I like watched Ben take the laptop and charger out for the next person that was like coming in. Like, that's so thoughtful.
Yeah. And I mean, just the fact that we can have a spare laptop and charger for people that don't have their own, that we can just keep in there and we know it's not going to walk away. Right. You know, that, and again, that's something like every new DJ that comes in, we kind of say, hey, this is the deal. Yeah. Like, it's like radio. Well, I always say it's like Radio Utopia. So basically it's a Radiotopia, but it's not. The station is kind of like this utopic community station where like nothing is broken and everyone's happy, which is kind of awesome.
Totally. So what were you doing for work when you moved to San Francisco and in the time that you were starting BFF?
So right around the time we decided to move to San Francisco, I got a call from an old boss of mine at a publishing company I'd worked at, and she was now working for a different publishing company, also in Massachusetts. And they were looking for a social media marketing person. They had never, this was a 75-year-old company that had never done anything online, really. They had a website, that was about it. So there was like no social presence, nothing. And so they needed someone to come in and build all of this stuff from the ground up. And she wanted me to do this job. But I told her, you know, that sounds like a really cool opportunity, but I'm about to move to San Francisco. But, you know, the internet is boundaryless. Yeah. Like I could do this job from San Francisco and I don't really think it would be that big of a deal. But the company had never had a remote employee before. And so they were really hesitant and they said, thanks, but no thanks. We're, you know, going to look elsewhere. And then it just so happened that 6 weeks later, my boss called me again and she was like, okay, same job, same situation, more desperate now. Yeah. Like I really just want to get this job filled. So at that point we were, I think like 3 or 4 months out from moving. So I told her, listen, I hate my job that I currently have. I'll leave tomorrow. I will quit that job. And in 2 weeks, I'll start working for you on a contract basis. Hire me on a 2-month contract. And then if at the end of the 2-month contract, you want me to continue, you can hire me as a remote employee. But if at the end of the 2-month contract, you know, you decide I'm not the right fit, I'll move to San Francisco. Right. So it's kind of a win-win for both of us. But obviously, it turned out that 1 month into the 2 months, they were like, yep, we were convinced. We trust you to work remotely. So that's what I had been doing up until, I guess, like 8 or 9 months ago. So I was working for... So I was working from home for this publishing company back east. So I was working like 6 to 2 or 3 in the afternoon. Nice. Yeah, that was nice. And then at night, you know, doing BFF stuff. And I was always really transparent with my job about like, oh, hey, by the way, I run this community radio station. I don't think they fully understood what it was, but they knew about it and were like, yeah, that's cool. That they're like, as long as you're getting your job done, that's fine. And then in April of 2018, I got a call that there was a massive layoff at the company. And since I was the only remote employee, I was part of the layoff. And that was a real turning point, not just for me, but also for BFF.fm, because I had to really make a decision. What am I doing? And how can I keep this going and still be able to survive here in San Francisco? Yeah. So as soon as I got laid off, I started looking looking into jobs, remote jobs, couldn't really find anything that really worked with my schedule. Started picking up freelance jobs. So I'd be working, you know, 20 hours a week for a freelance client and then the rest of the time doing this. It also really lit a fire under me because it made me see how untenable the station was in a lot of ways. Just that, you know, if I'm not here, like I'm the one that, you know, is pouring all of myself into this. And if I'm not here, who's going to pick the programming and you know, keep things going and be that guiding force for the station? And so I started really thinking about, okay, two things need to happen. One, I really need to start delegating a lot of what I'm doing to other people, you know, not only for my own mental health, but also just so that people in the community have more of a stake in what's going on. And then the other part of it is, you know, we can't just rely on DJs to keep this running because they're already giving so much of themselves in that, you know, they're paying dues. Ben Ward from No Magic did all of the development for our website for free. Oh, wow. While he was working at Twitter. So yeah, like it's not even just me at this point. There's a lot of people that have poured a lot of themselves into it. And so I thought for the future of the station, I really needed to figure out a way to make this all more sustainable. And so the first step was I came up with this idea last May to do a monthly donor program. I decided to call it The Besties. So, and I think I did like a Twitter poll with a few different options, but I liked Besties the best from the beginning and other people did too. So I'm like, all right, The Besties. And the idea was if you donate $10 or more a month to the station, you get special perks. But the primary perk is really just, okay, well, now you're a part of this. You're, you know, even if you're not a DJ, you can be a listener who's more connected to what's happening here. And then also everyone gets an exclusive enamel pin, which I'm wearing right now. It's a little rock wearing sunglasses and headphones. I had a few different prototype pins made and I just wore them. And this was the one people liked the best. Really? So I was like, that's the bestie pin. It's because it's like really all about the merch.
Yeah. Why a rock?
Well, this is actually kind of funny. So BFF has won Best Radio Station in the SF Weekly Readers poll for 5 years in a row. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think it might be 6 times now. One of the times we won SF Weekly, they're partners with us. Like, we have a really good relationship with them. They thought they were going to do us this huge favor, and they designed an ad that was like, congratulations, BFF, you're a best radio station. And it said, like, you rock. And the ad was just really bad. Like, they had just, I think they had an intern do it. And so they just cut and paste, like, elements from our website into, like, an ad template, and they were like, here you go. So I sent that to my friend and former BFF.fm DJ Allison Gore, who does all of the station imaging. And I sent her the ad and I was like, okay, can you do something with this? And basically what she did was she drew this rock and had a bubble that said you rock, like coming out of it's like head. Yeah. And so, yeah, so then this became the cool rock. And we use it on a lot of our advertising. And yeah, people, we've made magnets and people for some reason really, really gravitate towards the cool rock. So yeah. We're like, okay, the cool rock is like the symbol of besties now. But yeah, so we launched a campaign in July of 2018 to try to recruit 100 besties. The idea being that if we had 100 besties giving us $10 a month, we would suddenly have $1,000 a month in recurring income that we could rely on, which would, you know, be beneficial for a number of reasons. We ended up with, we now have 137 besties. Okay. And some of them, they're donating anywhere between $10 and $50 a month. Wow. So we have different levels. We're like 50-50 with money coming in from listeners versus money coming in from DJs. And we have some DJs that they've gotten their dues covered just from besties donating. And then they themselves have become a bestie. Okay. So they kind of make this transition from, you know, I'm paying dues because I have to I'm contributing because I believe in this mission.
Are most of the besties based in San Francisco or the Bay Area? Do you know? Or are they all over the place?
Yeah, most of the besties are located in the Bay Area, but we have people from other places as well. We have a few shows that are from places outside of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. When I started the station, I tapped my existing radio community, and so three of the shows are produced by my friends from back in Massachusetts. Okay. And it's really cool because they were like really, they're like, oh yeah, I'll do a show for a little while to fill up your schedule, and then they got really into it. And so now, like, I think three or four of the original shows that were made by people in Massachusetts are still on the air. And then we also have one DJ who's in Plymouth, UK. Okay. And so we, you know, so anywhere where we have a DJ local, we have a little pool of support from there. Yeah. But the two other things we've noticed, one, a lot of our besties are moms.
Really? So, like at home moms, like, or
just like moms of DJs. Like, so they're like, you know, keep it. You're like, thank you for keeping my kid off the streets. So it's cool. But the other big trend I'm noticing is a lot of our besties are people who lived in San Francisco at one time and don't any longer, but want to keep that connection. And listening to BFF.fm is how they stay connected to the community.
Yeah. Is there a reason why you've like focused on being a San Francisco station, at least that's what it sounds like, versus, since you are internet radio, versus like there's that NTS station that's like pretty global, instead of like going that route, or is the goal to eventually go that route? How do you look at the like local scene versus the bigger, wider like internet radio?
I think especially where BFF has really had an organic growth. We haven't really focused on, you know, developing business partnerships or collecting sponsorship money from big corporations. So basically, we've had really big things in mind, but we're just taking, you know, a more methodical approach to get there. I think you can't be a station that's all things to all people. So really, focusing locally is just our niche. So, you know, that's really the thing that's differentiating us from other online radio stations that are maybe trying to be more general about the type of music that they're playing. Although we do, you know, we play artists from everywhere. It's just, you know, we also have this local focus. But my thinking behind that and what the larger vision for the station is, you know, when people think of Seattle, they think of KEXP, mm-hmm. because that's a station that has just become such an integral part of the community there and a part of the music scene that the two just kind of go hand in hand. That's what I would love for BFF.fm to be for San Francisco. By focusing on the Bay Area, you know, I really want to set the standard where in the future, maybe we have a global audience, but the people that are listening are coming to the station because they want to hear what the Bay Area sounds like.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
And I mean, the other part of focusing on San Francisco is just that, as you know, things are really precarious here right now for artists and musicians, and there's a real need to have a resource that's available to local musicians without any strings attached, and something that's looking out for these people in a more, you know, positive and generous way. So, you know, you can, if you want to be on BFF and promote a record, you basically just have to, you know, find a connection with the DJ and they'll have you on and you can promote yourself and it's free. We also book about 30 shows around San Francisco each year, and we pay generously to the bands that come and do that.
It's a lot of shows.
Yes, it varies. Some we book ourselves and then some will hop on to something existing and help them with promotions and have the bands on and support them in that way. Okay. 12 shows a year are, we call them bestie bashes, and they're just really small showcases that we have here at our studio, and they're free for besties, but anyone can come. And we highlight, you know, it's like three super local bands that are really good, but, you know, probably haven't played in a big venue before.
Yeah.
And then we collect donations at the door, and that's split between the bands. And we've been paying the bands, I think, we've been paying them $100 each. So these are bands that, you know, might be playing an art space where they get like $25 or something, and that's like a really good day. So we try to pass the money along to the bands just to help them get started and help sustain them.
And these are bands that like you and local and the other DJs are just fans of or know, or talent that you respect?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, again, thinking about the station as kind of an organic thing. A lot of the shows we book are bands that we've already built a relationship with because they've been on shows or they're friends with DJs. So it's really kind of being a part of this local community and creating something that's a reflection of that.
Are they typically different genres too, the bands or each show? How does that usually work?
The shows that we do for the most part are very eclectic, because people don't just listen to one. Yeah, the station is. People don't just listen to one kind of music. Usually when we get asked to participate in a larger scale show, there are certain things that we look for in what the lineup looks like. Are there women? Are there people of color? Are the genres varied? Is it interesting because it's representing, a few different points of view in one show? A couple times we've been asked to collaborate on shows that are already partly booked. And whenever possible, I'll ask if we can have influence on how the booking is finished. For example, we worked with Rickshaw Stop. They were doing a show with Yumi Zuma and Chad Valley. And I love the band Werewolf. And they're in a similar vein as far as, you know, genre-wise. They're an electronic band, which the rest of the show was. But this was a local band that had never played a gig of that size before, and it sold out. So it was super exciting for them because it was, you know, like 500 people were there and got to see them and be exposed to them for the first time. So it was just something that, again, you know, kind of helped lift them up in a small way to get to the next level. So yeah, that's kind of how we approach it. Like, is everything that we're doing representative of this really cool and eclectic area that's made up of, you know, vastly different people that are working together?
So being so connected, how would you describe San Francisco's music, or the Bay Area, San Francisco, Oakland's music scene today?
I mean, I think a lot of the negative things people say about the music scene are true. You know, it's extremely expensive here. It's hard to stay here. I think there's a perception that might be true, that maybe there's more infrastructure for being in the music industry in places like LA, and that's why people go there. But I also think on the flip side, you know, every few years we have this sound the bell, the scene is dead. And I think that that doesn't really represent the scene as a whole. It's just representing one genre or one aspect of the scene going away. So, you know, for example, a few years ago, there was this like garage mass exodus where all the really cool garage bands either moved to LA or broke up. And, you know, people wrote articles like long live. Yeah, yeah. So I actually lived one building over from John Dwyer. And this is, I shouldn't admit this, like on tape, but when John Dwyer moved away, I like watched out my window and I was like, oh no. And my husband was like, you're insane.
Yeah.
Like he was like, this is the creepiest thing I've ever seen you do. Cause I was just sitting there like, oh no, he's driving the U-Haul. No, he's pulling away. And I was just like, yeah, I did take that really personally. But at the same time, you know, there's San Francisco State and, you know, there's schools here and young kids are coming here, you know, still even now, and because they want to do something creative here. And there are new bands that are developing all the time. I think that the state of the music scene in San Francisco in specifically is that the scene's not dead yet, but it's looking a little pale.
Yeah.
And we should probably try to help it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there
venues are closing and stuff too, right? I've only heard this hearsay.
So. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're losing venues. The city kind of needs to make a decision on how involved in this whole thing they want to get, and what, you know, what they might want to do to protect the music scene, which I do think that they're thinking about. But yeah, I mean, the other part of that is, you know, venues are closing, but there's always little DIY spaces. And with Ghost Ship, that, you know, that really endangered those types of creative spaces. But I think now maybe there's more of that sort of thing happening that we just don't see on the surface. So I'm not, you know, I'm not ruling out the San Francisco music scene just yet. Our DJs are young. The bands that they bring in are young. You know, we're seeing new bands forming and coming in all the time. So maybe there's little pockets that are going to get bigger and then start swallowing up other bands around them and becoming more of a movement, or at least having some sort of momentum. But maybe it's just like really early in that process for the next big, like, garage wave or whatever wave it's going to be.
Totally. Yeah, you can't help but to think, like, where are they going to live after college?
yeah, I mean, that's... and I, you know, I definitely think that there are a lot of people that choose to live in Oakland because it's cheaper. Although, one of our newest DJs told me that he lives in the Outer Sunset because he couldn't afford to live in Oakland. And so he was like, yeah, the cheapest place I could find was way Outer Sunset. And so that's where I am. And there's actually a lot of really, like, a lot of the really cool up-and-coming bands in San Francisco are in the Outer Sunset.
Yeah, I love the Outer Sunset. It's, like, one of my favorite neighborhoods in America.
Yeah, I, you know, it's funny.
I almost don't want to, like, share this with
you. I live in the Castro primarily because I, you know, want to live close to the station so I can get here quickly. But I always joke, like, one day I'm going to retire to the Outer Sunset. Yeah. It's great out there. It's like a whole other world.
Yeah, I could see that.
Don't move there, though. It sucks.
It's the worst. Yeah, I feel like if I moved to San Francisco, that's where I'd want to be for sure. I could see there being, like, bands. Like, met someone on the sidewalk there the other day. Like, that's the type of, and, like, talked for, like, 20 minutes. That's the type of neighborhood it is. Sweet. I want to backtrack a little bit. You were talking about kind of, like, making everything sustainable, more sustainable, and delegating. In what ways have you started to delegate?
So we're in kind of an interesting moment in BFF history right now because so we formed as a nonprofit in 2015 and we set the terms of our board of directors for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And in that 3 years, while we made a lot of positive change, one thing that we didn't do is we never really wrote anything down or like codified anything. A lot of it was just, you know, like totally living in my head. And in the past 3 years, I've just been running around. There's been, you know, it's really been a lot of energy just to kind of keep things going and growing and building a momentum. I'm not beating myself up over this, but I do totally recognize that why haven't we ever had a strategic plan? Why don't we have more rote descriptions of what people on our board should be doing, or a volunteer program that can involve members of the public and not just our DJs? So that's really what I've been working on with the current board now is, you know, really getting all of that organizational stuff in place so that we can sustain as an organization, so we know what path we're on and where we're going, and if anything should happen and I decide to step away or if I got hit by a bus, you know, hopefully my hope is that BFF would be able to continue even long past my involvement in it. I see myself as the founder of the station, and I do recognize that I, you know, I'm kind of the life force in it at this moment, but I don't want the station to live and die by me. You know, I really want it to be a sustainable organization for San Francisco that can be an asset to the city and something that people can be proud of.
Yeah, totally. That's, I know from experience that, like, wanting something to exist beyond you, but also having this really personal attachment to it is a tough thing to navigate.
Yeah. So a couple weeks ago, I, you know, I've been interviewing for jobs, and I got pretty close to this, to a job offer. They wanted me to come in one last time just to meet the team to make sure that I was a good fit, but it was looking like a done deal. But they'd said, you know, we don't do work from home. We don't do remote. You have to be here specific hours. It's like a really small company and they want everyone present. And it was a really cool opportunity, but I was like, okay, I can't do this, you know? So I went to the board and, you know, just said, this is, you know, this is really where I'm at. I'm at a bit of a crossroads where, you know, I'm just spending more and more time focusing on the station. And I've been able to do this for free up until this point because I've had a job to fall back on that wasn't particularly strenuous. You know, my job, I would do social media, so like sometimes stuff would come up on the weekends, but for the most part, you know, it wasn't like super high stakes. Yeah. So I could kind of focus on two things at once. Now I'm in a position where if I want to grow my own career, I'm going to have to take that next step where I'm going to have to really focus on what it is I'm doing and not focus on the station. And I don't really feel like the station is at a point where I could really walk away from it and have it last. So the board recently voted to start paying me, which is really interesting because we're like, okay, cool. Now how do we do that? Yeah. So we're trying to figure out the logistics of that. It's really funny because I've never been more excited to get paid minimum wage in my life. And it's also interesting. I've been thinking a lot over the past couple of days because I haven't started getting paid yet, but we're like working on it. Yeah, I've been thinking about like, does this ruin like my relationship to what it is I'm doing? Because it's like when I was taking psychology classes, there was like an experiment where like the kids were running through someone's backyard. So the way the person disincentivized the kids from running through the backyard was to give them a dollar anytime they ran through the backyard. So when you make something a job, it becomes a job and less of a passion. So I've been really thinking about that a lot and like making sure that I'm still as excited about it and it doesn't feel like as much of an obligation. I don't know, putting so much of your time and effort into something that you're not getting paid for is both like life-affirming and soul-crushing at the same time. Yeah. Just because I really love this and I believe in it and I think it's really important and needs to happen. And I see how that reflects on the people that are part of the community, where big things like one show got a book deal and they're writing a book, to small things. The other day I met someone who's...
Wait, one of your shows got a book deal?
Yeah, one of our shows got a book deal.
Oh, wow.
And the other day I ran into someone who was friends with a DJ and we were chatting, and in the course of our conversation, he said, I love what like this has done for her. Mm-hmm. Like he was like, she's so much more confident and this has really like given her a lot. And he was kind of saying like, thanks for doing that. That's really cool. And that's, you know, that's something that I take really seriously and I think is really important and valuable and, you know, really fuels what I'm doing. But, you know, over the past like 8 or 9 months, especially, so my husband was telling me that there's this term in startup culture called the trough of sadness. And I think I've been pretty firmly in that trough. I think like towards the end of 2018, I started to kind of come out of it because I was like, okay, well, we're making money now and things seem more stable and there are more people that are involved with the station that really want to be hands-on and get more proactively involved. So I feel a lot better in 2019 than I did, like, let's say, like last summer, where there were moments where I was just like, why am I even doing this?
I think there's something collectively happening. I know a lot of people who are going through something similar last year, myself included.
Yeah, 2018 was just really rough in general for some reason. We had a board meeting like right when I got laid off and I was like really trying to figure out what it was I was doing. And we talked about, you know, how could we make it, like basically how could we make a job that I could do so that I could focus on this and not have to worry about making money otherwise. And one of the board members said, well, one of the options is you just shut it down. And it was like the worst. Yeah, like it was just the worst possible suggestion to me. And I like went home and cried about it for like hours and like started thinking through, well, what if this is a failure? Like, what if this is over now. It was really funny because I started thinking to myself, well, okay, well, if this doesn't work out, if we have to shut it down, I'll just figure out a way to start something similar and, you know, rebuild something different, you know, learning from the mistakes that I made this time. Mm-hmm. So we'll just, okay, I'll like, we'll take some time off, we'll reformulate, we'll like come up with something new. So like, it was never like, oh, you're not going to do this anymore. You're going to focus on like, you know, being a marketing director. It was more like, okay, yeah, no, I'm going to start another crazy like money sink, time sink radio station because I really believe that this needs to exist. And I'm like, mm-hmm. It really had a moment where I was like, wow, I am like truly insane. Yeah. Like, this is really like what my drive is and what I want to do. And just keep thinking of like, failure is not an option. Yeah. And it kind of wasn't for me. You know, it's like, I can't have put 5 years into this and have it end like this.
I feel like even, and fortunately you're not, definitely don't want to see it end, but even if it did, I wouldn't see that as a failure. It's had a great run, and in many ways it's been super successful.
Yeah, definitely. Other people have told me that too. I see things like all the time. I see other organizations that started around the same time we did and have made the decision to end. And then the people that worked on those work on something, you know, slightly different. So yeah, I can appreciate that. Think like more where I get hung up is just thinking about the people that are currently involved and how much it means to them and how it's my responsibility to, you know, keep this going for those people that really care about it. It's debatable how healthy that is, but definitely.
You gotta look out for number one, too. There are only to go so far if you're not taking care of yourself and your needs. And,
Yeah, I mean, I think I have evolved a lot from the early days in which I would be here till like after midnight. At the beginning, I joke all the time because people call Forrest and I mom and dad, and there is kind of that relationship to the whole thing where like very early on in the project, it was like, okay, I have to like look after this all the time because if I look away, something could happen and that could like set off this chain of events that could negatively impact, you know, the whole like feeling of the whole thing. And so really early on, I was like involved with every single decision that was being made. I was always here like watching the DJs and helping them out. And now, you know, the station is kind of a toddler. Yeah. And I feel like I've put enough energy and attention into it that at the very least, the people that are part of it have a sense of what they should be doing, like what their part is in like keeping it going and like how the way they conduct themselves and do their shows and their involvement outside of their own shows with the greater community, how that kind of, you know, builds upon this groundwork that I laid. And now I'm finding people are actually drawn to that specifically. So they'll join the station because they want to do a radio show, but even more so because they just want to be a part of this project and give of themselves to build this greater thing. And so now we have a number of volunteers that are doing jobs that I don't even know what they're doing until they, you know, so for example, we have a few committees. We're moving towards like more of a committee structure where we're building committees that address different initiatives in our strategic plan. Mm-hmm. And then we'll recruit more board members, but the new board members will basically be the strategic driver for each of the committees that we've created. So we have a fundraising committee right now, and we have a couple really awesome volunteers. One person that develops a relationship with each donor. So she reaches out to each person after they donate and says thank you and asks for feedback. And we've gotten a lot of feedback and also a lot of people volunteering their time. And now I'm kind of like, okay, I got to figure out what to do with all these people. And then we have someone else that does in-kind donations. And so for example, for the past couple of years, we've done this event at Virgil's called Cocktails for a Cause. Mm-hmm. And the first year we did it, we did a raffle. And so I was running around trying to collect things for this raffle. And I'm like calling businesses and talking to DJs and getting people to make things. So this year, we have this awesome volunteer, Maddie. And so I said, hey, Maddie, we want to do this. We want to do like a raffle or a silent auction. So we just need a few things to put in. And I didn't hear from her for a couple of weeks. And so I checked in and I was just like, oh, hey, we should talk about this again. And she was like, oh, yeah, by the way, I got tickets to Treasure Island. I got this. I got that. She had like all these like really amazing donations that she had gotten from businesses. So while, you know, I had kind of like thrown the suggestion out there and she just ran with it. And I figured, oh, it's a couple weeks out. We'll now get started on this project. And she was like, no, I'm done. I've got everything. So we have a number of people that are doing things like that, like Ben with the development on the site. He knows what the vision is and he knows what it is we're trying to do. And so he's just constantly on his own time thinking, okay, well, how can I make a tweak to the site that might, you know, advance this mission or this idea.
Looks great, by the way.
Thanks. Yeah, he, like, one of the things we talked about as far as fundraising is I'd done a few webinars and talked to some people, and a big suggestion we got was to get more donors, you have to make the barrier to entry as low as possible. Mm. So it was recommended. Yeah, you just, you know, even if you feel like it's almost like egregious, you just put like donation buttons everywhere and different kinds of donation buttons. And so I kind of like pitched this idea to Ben, who was then like, okay, well, we can, you know, we can pepper them in. And so now wherever you are on the site, there's an opportunity to give. And we're finding that people do that. For example, on New Year's Eve, another DJ and I did a top 100 countdown where we played songs from the top 100 albums that were played on BFF in 2018 using our charts. And we also have a music director, Nick. He compiles the charts each week and sends out new music to the DJs. So he was like, oh yeah, it'd be really funny if you guys did like top 100. And I was like, all right, we're doing it. So we did the show, and then people actually found the top 100, people that weren't already connected with BFF or had listened before. And a few people listened to that show and then donated $5 or $10 to that specific broadcast.
Oh, wow.
Which was really amazing. Yeah. So, and that was like all just because of really good design that people were like, oh yeah, I'm listening to this and I'm enjoying it. Oh, there's a button right there where I can drop $5. Cool. Okay. So that's been a big thing. Yeah. The other thing that Ben is working on right now, which I think is amazing, is he has figured out how to Scrabble from his radio show to Last FM. Mm. So now he's looking into Scrabbling all of BFF to Last FM. Cool. So Last FM users can, if they see a band that they like, they see that we're playing it, they might come then to listen to BFF to find other similar artists, which I think is really big.
Yeah, that's awesome. Before I ask you our last question, I want to go back to where you're at today and the, like, you're to get paid for doing what you do here, minimum wage, and you're mentioning like the delicate balance between passion and getting paid and stuff. Do you ever have the thought, like, I just wish I could do this full time? I wish this was my full focus? Or, like, what's next for you?
I think if I do my job correctly, it will be my full focus. Now, I will be working full time, making minimum wage. But obviously, you know, this is San Francisco, so I am still going to need to do, you know, some freelance work on the side or pick up some DJ gigs to make a little extra money. I kind of think of it as a basic income experiment where the money that I'm going to get from working full time at BFF will be like the bare minimum I need to survive. So I'm interested to see how that changes my thinking. I'm hoping that because I will not have such a split focus, I'll be able to really think more clearly and be more innovative about like what's happening at the station, because I'll have more bandwidth to dedicate.
Maybe stuff will make a big difference.
Yeah, because like right now I'm like, you know, up until now, it's been like, okay, well, so I'm going to, I'm going to spend a couple hours like writing this email or like working on this part of the strategic plan. Oh, but then at 2:00, I have to hop on this call and talk to this company about writing a marketing plan for them. So it'll be really amazing to have hours of interrupted brain space to devote to this. And I really want to spend that time and energy on focusing on really shoring up BFF as an organization so that one day we can be big enough that my job could really become, you know, an actual career. I think, you know, it's gone from passion project to job, and the future would be making it a career.
Let me know if this is too personal and I can take it out. But your husband works in tech.
My husband is a tax implementation consultant. Okay. So he is kind of a developer, kind of customer service for million-dollar software. So he helps Fortune 500 companies he's worked for Walmart, Amazon, Walgreens. He helps large corporations calculate the taxes that they need to pay. Okay. So like sales tax, VAT, all that stuff. We looked at an apartment one time and the landlord called what he did low tier tech. And we were kind of like, we're not living in your house.
Yeah.
Like, we're not giving you our hard earned low tier tech. So yeah, he's like a techie person, but doesn't work in the tech industry. So he makes decent money, but definitely not that Google money.
Gotcha. So you're still like, everything counts.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel extremely grateful that he supports what I'm doing because he has advanced in his career and he's been able to make more money. And that's been directly proportional to me making less money.
Yeah.
So right around the time I got laid off, he got this huge bonus and he was promoted. And basically immediately I swallowed up all of that, you know, new income by, you know, working freelance and taking a pay cut. And, you know, and now it really is like, he's really making up the difference. So like, if he wasn't supportive or didn't, you know, wasn't successful, then we certainly wouldn't be in this position. So yeah, I'm really grateful for that. I was just talking to a friend the other day and I was like, you know who needs to be thanked? Forrest Guest, man.
Yeah.
I was like, he's the real one making it happen.
It's interesting too, to think about like what you're doing is like very punk rock in many ways, and also, but like, we still need this balance of support that comes from corporations.
Yeah, and that is another thing that I think is totally reflected in the music scene, where, you know, maybe in the past the average band was like five guys that all are living in like a basement apartment together, but now you're seeing bands where it's like, okay, four of the members are baristas or you know, work in the service industry so they can be flexible, and then one of the members works for a big tech company and has an unlimited vacation policy, and that's how they're able to go on tour. So it's kind of interesting because there is like, I do really see that happening a lot here, where, you know, the money has to come from somewhere. Maybe it's one member of the band works a corporate tech job. Maybe it's a band gets popular enough that they start getting hired to
get the corporate tech.
Yeah. I mean, that's something.
It's a weird environment we're in.
Yeah, like that's another thing about the local scene that's so like weird and frustrating is that, you know, you have these big tech companies that could be investing in the music scene or investing in art and culture in the Bay Area. But for a lot of them, the way that they do that is by cherry picking bands and having them play on campus.
And paint murals on campus.
Yeah. So that stuff is just, you know, going behind a wall that very few people get to see, and it's not available to the public. And then the other thing that does is, you know, let's say, I'm also thinking, and this is, you know, tech companies, but also private clubs.
Mm-hmm.
So places like the Battery, they hire, you know, a lot of local and touring bands. Like, a band will come through and maybe they'll play a show at the Independent, but then the next night they'll be at the Battery. And so that just disincentivizes people from going out.
Is the Battery a private? I've never heard of it before.
Yeah, the Battery is a private club in downtown. But yeah, and they, you know, they pride themselves on, you know, being champions of art and culture. And certainly part of the mix is giving opportunities to bands to come in and play and make good money. But if you're doing that at the expense of venues and you know, the public at large,
right,
you know, you have to ask how good how good is that really? Right. Yeah. I mean, it would be really cool if, you know, instead of having bands go to the Twitter office on Market Street you know, Twitter sponsors an event and encourages their employees and the public to go. And they use, you know, a venue that's already in existence and can support mass numbers of people to go there. Do you know what about what Bandcamp has been doing?
Oh, yeah, they're opening that space in Oakland, right?
Yeah, Bandcamp is great. Like, I think Bandcamp is a great example of a big business that's giving back in a really impactful and meaningful way. They just announced that their new office that they're opening in Oakland is going to also be a record store and venue that will be open to the public. And they've hired a few people that I know in the music industry that are just, like, really great and really cool. And, like, this will be a great opportunity for them to, you know, make some sustainable income and then also support this mission. And I'm really excited about it. I hope that it lives up to the promise of, you know, giving smaller bands an opportunity to play, giving teenagers an opportunity. They were saying that they're focusing on all ages shows. I think another big missed opportunity in the city is that no one's really thinking about the teenagers. Where, you know, where are they going to see music? How are they getting inspired to start a band?
And to stay.
Yeah, and to stay. Right, yeah. I mean, if you're like a teenager, if you're a native teenager and you grow up here, you don't see that path to being able to do creative work and stay in your hometown.
Right.
You know, why would you stay?
Right. Totally. Yeah. Cool. A couple more questions. One is, are you accepting any new DJs?
Yeah, so we're always looking for new DJs. Right now, we have a handful of time slots in our overnight shows. So we're looking for, I think, 3 or 4 DJs from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. Yeah, but you don't have to wake up that, you don't have to stay up, I guess. Our studio is live from 8 a.m. to midnight. And then after midnight, all of the DJs that are on late night or early morning actually pre-record their shows in our second studio, a Studio B, which is where we're sitting right now. DJs can just work with their own schedule. So for example, after we finish here today, there's a DJ that's coming in to record an interview with the band, and then her show airs at 2 a.m. on Saturdays. And then because we have our archives online, you don't have to get up at 2 a.m. to listen either. A lot of the overnight shows people will listen to on their own time, which I think is really cool.
Love the archives.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, we used to not really do anything before 8 a.m. and thought, like, well, no one's really listening before 8 a.m. And we started getting feedback from people taking Caltrain. Mm-hmm. So people that have to, like, hop on Caltrain at 6:30 and they're like, I want to listen to BFF on Caltrain.
Yeah.
Or people on the East Coast or other places. So yeah, being able to have the schedule be 24/7 really opens us up to opportunities to connect with listeners from all over the world.
Totally. Where can people find BFF FM?
Obviously, the main way to listen to BFF.fm is to go to BFF.fm. But we are also on most of the third-party apps for listening to radio. So you can listen to us on Simple Radio, TuneIn, Radio Garden, and SoundTap. Although every once in a while, someone points out that we're on something new. So whatever you use, if we're not already on it, you can contact us and we can look into it. The only thing we're not on is iHeartRadio because it's owned by a big corporation. They wouldn't let us on. We asked. And you can also listen to any past episodes on our website. So if you go to BFF.fm and click on shows, you can look at the shows by day or at our full schedule. We have genre tags on each show. So if you prefer a different genre of music, you can sort by genre, and that shows you everything that's ever been broadcast. So you can even discover a show that was maybe on the station 2 years ago, but still has relevant music that you might like to listen to.
Cool. What's your show? Want to plug your show?
Sure, yeah. So I have a show on Mondays from 4 to 6 p.m. It's the Best Frequencies Forever Top 30 Countdown. Basically, I'm not only the founder, but I'm also the Casey Kasem / Ryan Seacrest of the station. Each week, our music director compiles a chart of the 30 most popular albums on the station, and I do a countdown-style show where I play tracks from each of those. And it's, like, really fast-moving and a lot of fun, and it's a great way, if you're interested in BFF and haven't listened before, it's a great way to just get kind of a sense of the flavor of the station and see what kind of stuff is getting played.
Yeah, cool. Last question. What's something you're excited about today?
Wow, what's something I'm excited about today? Yeah. I'm excited about lunch. That's definitely a big thing. Yeah, I'm excited about, I have been, one of the projects I've been working on is I've been working with a couple of pro bono consultants. One working on a strategic plan for the station. So the board had kind of come up with, you know, these are the initiatives or the areas we want to focus on, but we haven't like written it all down. So I'm working with someone on that. So I'm excited. I have to go home and work on that this afternoon, but I'm excited about it because that's a really important and vital document that will really enhance what we're doing and give us focus. I'm also working with a board development consultant, and he sent me this really long email at the beginning of us talking, so I'm really excited to, he has some opinions and I can't wait to hear what they are.
Cool. Awesome. Thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Yeah. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.